The head of Lebanon's Hezbollah movement hails the rule of resistance in confronting threats from Israel, which calls a racist and apartheid entity. The U.S. police in New Jersey are under fire for their racially motivated response to a scuffle between the black and a white team. Also in the headlines, the Canadian police warn truck drivers blockading downtown Ottawa to depart or face arrest, as a minister says extremist groups help organize protests. Secretary General of Lebanon's Hezbollah movement hails resistance groups for defending the country in the face of Israel's military attacks and threats over the past decades.
The resistance, with all its factions, including Hezbollah, is the resistance is what preserved the identity of Lebanon, the identity of Lebanon that was going to be erased completely with the invasion of 1982. Every single person who comes and questions the identity of Lebanon today should remember 1982, in the year 2000, in 2006, and until today, it is the resistance that preserved the identity of Lebanon. It preserved it with blood, with sacrifice, with fighting and struggle and jihad, and it continues to preserve it until today.
Sayed Hassan Nasrallah was speaking in a ceremony commemorating the martyrs of resistance. He denounced Israel as a racist and apartheid entity, saying the regime is on the decline. Nasrallah also touched upon Hezbollah's military capabilities. He said the movement has been producing drones in Lebanon and has the ability to turn thousands of rockets into precision-guided missiles. Political commentator Laith Maruf believes Israel's identity is intertwined with ethnic cleansing and genocide.
This is a manufactured state, and it's a colony made on fabricated mythology that doesn't even relate to reality. And it's an attempt to create an identity based on ethnic cleansing and genocide of the indigenous people. So the weakness for this artificial construct of both Zionism and the state that represents this ideology is weak as long as the indigenous people of the land, the Palestinians, the Arabs, resist that, even for if there's only one left Palestinian that is resisting, this fake entity cannot sustain this fake identity.
Israel has carried out yet another strike on Syria, targeting a town near the capital, Damascus. A Syrian military source says the missile attack has caused material damage. Our correspondent in Damascus, Muhammad Ali, has given us more about the raid.
An official military source said in a statement that there has been a new Israeli attack on Syria. What happened was that about 11:35 p.m. local time, Israel carried out an attack using surface-to-surface missiles launched from the occupied Syrian Golan. Those missiles targeted the Syrian army positions around a small town called Zakia in the southern part of Damascus, causing only material damage. Now, this is what the official military statement here says. This attack comes just about a week following a similar one that hit also the capital, Damascus, and killed a soldier and injured several others. Now, also this attack, it's very important to say that it comes just one day following a visit by the Russian Minister of Defense to Damascus. And also this attack comes despite the strong condemnation which the Russian Minister of Defense expressed over the previous Israeli attack that happened on the 9th of this month, in which at that time the Russian Ministry of Defense said that such an Israeli attack is definitely a blatant violation of Syrian sovereignty and will lead to an escalation of the situation.
Supporters of the Bahraini opposition have gathered in the Lebanese capital to mark the 11th anniversary of a popular uprising against the ruling monarchy in the Persian Gulf Kingdom. Our correspondent Mariam Saleh is in Beirut.
Despite a statement by Lebanon's Interior Minister Bassam Maulawi last week directing security forces to cancel any event critical of the Bahraini regime, prominent Bahraini opposition group Al-Wifaq held its scheduled event. The event, titled United for Justice, marked 11 years since Bahrain witnessed popular uprising demanding justice and political freedom.
As Bahraini opposition and Bahraini factions, we are working on unifying our stances. What unites us is more than what divides us. We're united in our cause, and our demands for justice and freedom are one.
Those who support the Bahraini opposition believe that the Bahraini people's struggle for freedom and any people's uprising for the sake of reform is similar to the Palestinian people's struggle for liberation from the Israeli occupation.
The struggle to face the forging of people's will and theft of their rights and resources and the hijacking of political decision, as well as fighting for human rights in Bahrain, are similar to facing the Zionist enemy in Palestine and facing corruption and wrong in Lebanon and facing the conspiracy in Syria. This is one confrontation and one battle. The Bahraini normalization of ties and the visit of the Israeli Prime Minister prove what we have been calling for in the last 10 years.
The political representatives and Muslim clerics attending the event stress that as Lebanon has always been a place for freedom of speech, opposition members of any country, as well as the Bahraini opposition groups, should be allowed to come here and speak. In addition to a violent crackdown on peaceful protesters, the Bahraini regime has now taken the lead in its normalization of ties with the Israeli regime, thereby going against its people's main cause. Experts believe this issue could further energize the Bahraini opposition in its struggle to be heard. Mariam Saleh, Beirut.
Iran's top negotiator in the Vienna talks is calling on other parties to be realistic and avoid excessive demands. In a tweet, Ali Bagheri Kani says it is time for them to take, quote, serious decisions in order to restore the 2015 accord. The diplomat says the months-long negotiations are closer than ever to an agreement. However, he stresses that nothing is agreed until everything is agreed. Russia's representative to the talks, Mikhail Ulyanov, has echoed Bagheri Kani's remarks, calling for final decisions to be made. Advisor to Iran's negotiating team in the Vienna talks, Mohammad Marandi, says no matter who's in charge in Washington, U.S. policies indicate that it's an unreliable partner in any talks.
The United States can't be trusted, nor can the Europeans be trusted, because we've seen that the Europeans do whatever the United States tells them to do, whether it's Obama, when he warns financial institutions, insurance companies, shipping companies, major investment corporations not to deal with Iran. That was a violation of the nuclear deal, and the Europeans went along with it. When Trump tore up the deal, the Europeans nagged about it, but they went along with it. Under Biden, the Europeans continue to pursue Trumpian maximum pressure sanctions. We have to keep in mind that as we speak, maximum pressure sanctions against women and children continue to be implemented both by the Europeans and the Americans. So under such circumstances, there's no reason for anyone in Iran to trust the Europeans or the Americans about their nuclear commitments, about their commitments to the nuclear deal, nor can the Iranians trust them about with regards to any other form of negotiations. When the Europeans and the Americans are seen as unreliable partners within the JCPOA, then how can other issues that go beyond the nuclear program be discussed with these countries in the hope that an agreement would be respected by the Europeans and the Americans?
U.S. law enforcement is once again facing accusations of double standards. Now, a video showing officers' response to a fight between two black and white teens has rekindled fears of racial bias. The footage shows the teenagers are arguing in a mall in New Jersey and police arrive to break up the brawl. Officers then tackle the black boy to the ground and handcuff him while the white one is seated on a couch and looks on. Social media users have reacted to police behavior and slammed it as racially motivated. The New Jersey governor has described the situation as racially disparate treatment by police. Anti-racism sentiments have remained high in the U.S. following several high-profile cases of police brutality against black Americans, including the murder of George Floyd in 2020. Earlier, we spoke to political analyst John Parker about U.S. police discriminations and brutality against black people. He believes that the U.S. administration's deliberately left the issue of racism unsolved to exert more power on Americans.
Many authorities in the health industry have said that black people are traumatized, suffering PTSD from racist policing. And it's been, like I said, it was going on. I'm 61 years old now. It's been going on for a very long time. And the question you have to ask is, why does it keep continuing when we know this problem exists? You know, Washington Post did a study that showed the police killings of almost 7,000 since 2015, and about 1,000 a year. And when you add to it that black people are killed at almost twice the rate of white people in the United States, then you see that this greater problem of racism and genocide against black and brown youth is consistent, and it goes from one administration to another. When they started taking those numbers, it was in 2015 during the Obama administration, and although he's African American, it still happened during the Biden, of course, the Trump administration. It's still happening today, and they refuse to do anything about it. They know it exists, but it serves a purpose under capitalism. It serves the purpose of keeping people in fear so they don't fight back, so they don't fight the repression that's continually happening, and it also serves the thing of racism allows you to divide the working class. So it's a key tool, an integral tool of capitalism to keep us divided and weak.
Police in the Canadian capital vow to further crack down on truckers that are blocking downtown Ottawa for COVID-19 restrictions. Police now warn the truckers to clear the area or face arrest. The federal public safety minister blames extremist groups for helping organize the protests. Marco Mandicino says some actors want to overthrow the government. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has invoked little-used emergency powers to end the prolonged protests. The extraordinary move has sparked criticism, with one opposition politician calling it, quote, a hammer on Canadians. Tens of people have been arrested following Trudeau's announcement on Monday. The protesters have blocked several U.S.-Canada border crossings and clogged streets across the country. A number of British Muslim teaching staff are demanding a new public inquiry after an investigative podcast revealed that government ministers may have fueled an Islamophobic purge based on a fabricated extremism plot. The notorious Trojan horse affair rocked Britain in 2014 and led the way for the hostile anti-Muslim climate, which affects ordinary British Muslims today. Robert Carter headed to Birmingham to speak to the victims of what's now called a witch hunt.
British Muslim victims of a government-backed anti-Islamist crackdown on Muslim-majority schools in Birmingham have issued fresh demands for justice after a new investigation revealed that the government may have acted against them based on bogus extremism threat claims. A podcast series published by the New York Times titled The Trojan Horse Affair alleges that numerous players, including Government Minister Michael Gove, penalised several schools and their staff, despite knowing the accusations weren't credible.
Knowing all of these facts and background, he went on to launch an offensive against our schools and brought down what were, you know, highly successful schools within a matter of months. This was a clear abuse of authority and abuse of power, for which I think that people should be held to account.
The Trojan Horse affair began in 2014 after a mysterious letter was sent anonymously to Birmingham Council. The letter outlined a supposed plot by Muslim extremists to infiltrate, take over and radicalise schools. On the back of the letter, inquiries were launched, followed by an Islamophobic media frenzy, which then led to several Muslim teachers being sacked or banned from their work.
What we observed and we witnessed this firsthand was institutional racism, institutional corruption, and institutional Islamophobia. The media had a social responsibility to ensure that there was a balance and a reporting of facts. but this was not the case.
Speaking to Press TV, the Muslims targeted say they are victims of a state-backed witch hunt and that the extremism accusations were devastating.
I was unable to get any job. I was even refused voluntary posts. People wouldn't even accept my voluntary work because my name and personality had been stigmatized. I've been vilified, and the label of extremism and radicalism had been attached to my name. So it made me unemployable, quite frankly.
I would also say to Michael Gove, damages and compensation are due, and my ban and the ban of my fellow colleagues need to be lifted immediately.
After spending the day here in Birmingham, it's very clear that the negative effects that the Trojan Horse affair has had on the Muslim community still resonates very strongly. And with the victims' hunger for justice as strong now as it's ever been, the question is, what will be done to hold those who did any wrongdoing during the affair to account going forward? Robert Carter, Birmingham.
That's the world news for now. Thank you.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
In Britain, the former Brexit minister David Frost has joined Conservative MPs in writing an open letter to Prime Minister Boris Johnson, calling for a resumption of fracking in the United Kingdom. In another indication of the ongoing battle within the Conservative Party over environmental issues. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian's political correspondent Peter Walker. The piece is titled, David Frost Joins Tory MPs in Calling for Return of Fracking in UK. In Britain, the former Brexit minister David Frost has joined Conservative MPs in writing an open letter to Prime Minister Boris Johnson calling for a resumption of fracking in the United Kingdom, in another indication of the ongoing battle within the Conservative Party over environmental issues. Lord Frost argued that extracting domestic shale gas would give the UK a competitive and reliable source of energy. But Zach Goldsmith, a key Green voice within the government, said it would not reduce energy prices and would put ministers at war with furious communities. The letter to the Prime Minister was organised by the Conservative Net Zero Scrutiny Group of Conservative MPs, which argues against many green levies and targets, saying the government should prioritise lower energy costs and more secure supplies. Last week, leading climate scientists told The Guardian that the group appeared to be trying to delay a shift towards lower emissions by including climate policies in a cultural war and spreading disinformation, a charge that the Conservative Net Zero Scrutiny Group rejects. The MP's letter, shared with the Sunday Telegraph, said shale gas deposits around Lancashire and surrounding counties offer at least 50 years of cheap and sustainable gas. It read, "If levelling up is to mean anything, it must be centred around empowering communities, rather than telling them what they can and cannot do. With a lack of public debate about our strategy to reach net zero emissions, we have abandoned this fundamental Conservative principle. It's time to reverse this moratorium." The Sunday Telegraph said 29 MPs had signed the letter, but named only five of them: Craig McKinley, Steve Baker, John Whittingdale, Bob Blackman, and Julian Knight. The organisers of the letter declined to reveal any more names. The former Brexit minister David Frost, who has emerged as a leading dissident voice on the Tory right since resigning from his ministerial role in December, told The Telegraph that fracking would bring a competitive and reliable source of energy and reduce reliance on imports. But Zach Goldsmith, a Foreign Office minister and peer, said that to even replace half the gas the United Kingdom imports would require 6,000 fracking wells, with all the associated industrial equipment and endless movements of trucks ferrying toxic chemicals and wastewater to and from sites. It's hard to imagine communities across the United Kingdom being okay with that. In a series of tweets, Zach Goldsmith said fracking was deeply unpopular with the British public, and that since any shale gas extracted would be sold at international market prices, it would have no impact on UK energy bills. Gas was still needed, he said, but added, "To have any impact at all, government would need to rig the market and go to war with furious communities. On every level, the cost would be enormous." The former Tory Chancellor, George Osborne, who offered fracking companies generous tax breaks in his 2013 budget before drilling licences were later revoked, told the House of Lords Committee that extra gas production would only increase employment. George Osborne said fracked gas would be a small proportion of global production and would therefore have little influence on the international prices that dictate what the UK households pay. The government's position remains that fracking is unproven as a resource in the United Kingdom, and that the inability to accurately predict earth tremors associated with it meant it could not be supported. The Conservative Net Zero Scrutiny Group is campaigning alongside Cordrilla, the company that operated two shale wells in Lancashire. Work at these were stopped in late 2019. When the government halted fracking in England after warnings about possible earthquakes. On Thursday, 10th of February, Cordrilla announced it was plugging and abandoning its two shale wells at the Preston New Road site in Preston, Lancashire, under instructions of the government's oil and gas authority. News of this was announced in a joint press release between Cordrilla and the Conservative Net Zero Scrutiny Group, NZSG, including quotes from the group's chair and vice-chair, Tory MPs Craig McKinley and Steve Baker, calling the decision utter madness. Similarly, the Telegraph article about the Conservative Net Zero Scrutiny Group's letter was published alongside a comment piece from the chief executive of Cordrilla, Francis Egan, calling domestic fracking a no-brainer.
Food for thought.
Hello everyone, and here are some interesting points to ponder upon as elucidated by the leader of the pious and the commander of the faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him. The whole good is gathered in three characters: consideration, silence, and worthing. Every consideration that lacks learning lessons is inattention. Every silence that lacks thinking is inadvertence. And every wording that lacks the mention of God is nonsense. Blessed are those whose consideration teaches them lessons, whose silence causes them to think, and whose wording is mention of God, who weep for their sins and save people from their evil.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This is A to Z. Introduction to Islamic Lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. This is A to Z, coming to you from IRIB English Radio, and I'm your host, Ali. This radio show is about Islamic lifestyle, and in each episode, we will be talking about a different lesson. Please stay with us till the end of today's program. Today's lesson, not committing a sin. A sincere Muslim gives primary attention to doing good deeds. As we know, even the best of us may sometimes fail to reject a tempting poor choice. Instead, a blameworthy deed is about to be committed. If a person ends up not committing the intended sin, after having determined to do al-azm, which is, you know, strong determination, he or she falls into one of the following categories regarding that intended action. Number one, a person who leaves the intended bad deed undone out of fear of Allah. That is, for the sake of pleasing Allah and intending to conform to what Allah requires. In such case, this person is awarded and rewarded for changing his mind and, in the end, determining not to do that bad deed. Number two, a person who leaves the intended bad deed undone out of fear of people. Now, in this case, it's not Allah, it is the fear of people. In such a case, this person has, even so, still committed a sin, a blameworthy act of heart, while leaving off the action of the intended sin is a rewardable act of worship, still it is rewardable only when done for the sake of pleasing Allah, not for the sake of looking good in the eyes of people around him. Whatever and whether they be fellow Muslims or non-Muslims. So see how these two scenarios, the only thing that changed was in one case, the person did not commit a sin for the sake of Allah. In the other case, he did not commit a sin for the sake of people. And the end result is entirely different. We're going to go over three more scenarios with you after the break. Welcome back, dear listeners. We discussed two scenarios of not committing a sin before the break, and now let's talk about the third one. A person who has determined to commit the bad deed but fails because he's not actually capable of carrying it out. He may be prevented by circumstances beyond his control. In this category, he doesn't seek the means to overcome those circumstances. Perhaps he simply loses interests for the time being. In such a case, this person is accounted as having committed a bad deed due to his having determined to follow through on something he had weighed in his heart and decided to go ahead. Now, number four, a person who fails to commit the bad deed because he is incapable of doing so. In this category, unlike the previous one, he seeks, but unsuccessfully, the means of committing it. In such a case, a full bad deed is written to the account of this person because having the will to commit a sin is like committing it. In this case, he did not change his mind about trying to follow through the first category, nor did he stop seeking the means to fulfill his intention. Last but not the least is a person has a continuing intention and determination to perform a blameworthy deed. That person is punishable for it. Whether his continuing intention came before his first success at the bad deed or again after the further successful repetition of this bad deed. So if a person commits a sin and then he intends to do it again, when he again has the opportunity, this is a person who insists on committing sins. In that case, he is punishable for this intention, even if he never actually succeeds again in committing the sin. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
News, social news, scientific news, artistic news. With delight.
Now for those who are interested in archaeology, the remains of 14 mummies have been unearthed at an ancient site in central Peru. The mummies, believed to be over 1,000 years old, include 6 children and 8 adults. The tomb containing the bodies was found at an archaeological complex about 25 kilometers from the capital, Lima. Researchers discovered other objects such as clay pots, decorated calabashes, and some knitting gears near the mummies. They believe the children and adults were sacrificed in honor of a prominent local figure whose mummified body was found last November in the same area.
A group of people who were part of his environment were sacrificed, mainly children. It's quite possible that it was his children, his wives, who were sacrificed and buried in the surroundings of the tomb, and also his servants.
Van Dalen also says the discovery provides them with the oldest evidence of child sacrifice associated with the burial of an elite character in the pre-Inca era. The city of Cajamarquia, which was built out of mud in around 200 BC, is considered as one of the largest archaeological complexes in Peru.
A miniature bull in Germany's Bavaria is proving that size does not matter, as the small bovine makes himself comfortable in his new herd at an animal sanctuary. This tiny bull had a lucky escape and was rescued from a farmer who was taking him to a slaughterhouse. The mini cow is named Napoleon and was born with a genetic defect. Just 8 months old, the diminutive bull has already reached his full size. Napoleon might be small, but he is mighty and daring, as he is not afraid of joining a herd consisting of big and huge animals.
Napoleon belongs to the Dexter breed, which produces rather small cattle anyway. They grow up to be about 1.2 meters. With his 80 centimeters, he is of course far below that. Despite his size, he feels like a complete bull and is in a good mood. He has settled in with us very quickly, which we are very happy about. He also has a lively effect on the herd.
The little bovine now lives with 100 other rescued livestock. His rescuers say he gets along with other animals and has already become friendly with another rescued cow. The Dexter is a breed of cattle first originated in Ireland. They are usually bred for high-quality meat and milk. an Indonesian man frees a crocodile of a tire that was stuck around its neck some 6 years ago. Tilly, a self-taught rescuer and resident of central Sulawesi province, captured the reptile and cut the tie using a small saw with the help of some locals. The animal had been too smart to be trapped. Tilly says he had been tracking the reptile for weeks using a basic trap with a rope tied to a log. He used live chickens and dogs as bait to lure the reptile. The crocodile drew the sympathy of local residents who worried the tire would choke as it grows in size. Tilly says his main motive was to help animals, claiming it was not his first experience dealing with a crocodile.
Biologists in Peru release two birds back to their natural habitat after weeks of efforts to attend and conserve dozens of animals affected by an oil spill. Two birds were among some 200 animals found dehydrated and were brought to a veterinary hospital for treatment. Veterinarians, biologists, and volunteers have been leading the cleanup operation of the affected coast close to the capital, Lima. So far, several species have been released after rehabilitation. An oil tanker off the coast of Peru was hit by waves triggered by a volcanic eruption miles away in Tunga in January. Some 6,000 barrels of oil spilled into the ocean that polluted waters and beaches along Peru's Pacific coast.
There are all sorts of peculiar restaurants around the world, but not so many prison-themed eateries. One of them is in the Iranian capital, Tehran, and it is thriving.
The setting is engaging. If we want to suggest it to someone, it's because of the setting too. It's like a cell, both its title and the story of the owners. They wrote here they were inmates themselves and why they were in jail.
Cell 16 serves its customers in cells where they can wear mock prison uniforms. The owners say they got the idea for their diner while they were behind bars for debt. They say they are now open to help newly released inmates who find it hard to get employed and give out part of their proceeds to pay for debt inmates.
There have been several cases where an inmate came and worked here while on leave, and we helped and offered him money to help his problem.
The eatery was opened in 2016. The owners have now expanded their business and own two diners in Tehran and another in the central city of Isfahan. They say they are using their emerging restaurant chain to raise funds to free convicts who are serving time for unpaid debts.
A German man has claimed a new Guinness World Record in hula hooping. Kia Sandmeier set a new record for the longest duration of hula hooping in a plank position. He was able to carry the activity in this difficult pose for over 6 minutes. The 30-year-old says he practiced the plank rigorously in the morning and evenings before and after work. Sandmeier says holding the plank was the most difficult part. The previous record for this activity was set last year by an American with just over 3 minutes. Every year, the Copenhagen Light Festival transformed the winter cold and darkness of the capital city into a celebration of light art in Denmark. In February, the entire city becomes the stage displaying captivating lighting installations presented by Danish and international artists. The works are planted at more than 30 historical sites, canals, and squares, among other urban spaces. Building facades are also decorated with special lighting designs. The organizers and curators of the festival say the event is important because it gives people a chance to rediscover their own city. Also, the event brings life to a dark season that's normally very quiet by offering joyful experiences for locals and tourists alike.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
As the 2022 Winter Olympics have begun in the Chinese capital, Beijing, two playful giant pandas at the Moscow Zoo have come to the spotlight for predicting the outcome of the sports event. On the eve of the Winter Olympics opening, Ru Yi and Ding Ding were each offered five traffic cones labeled with national flags of the participating countries, represented by the largest numbers of athletes. The cones that got taken down by them were considered as the winners. The pandas then chose the cones with Chinese and German flags on them. Zoo officials say no treats were placed inside the cones to ensure that the prediction is unbiased. The zoo says it plans to continue the panda prediction for all individual and team competitions at the Games. The 15th edition of the Tehran International Tourism and Handicrafts Exhibition has wrapped up. As Salman Khojouri reports, Iran ranks first globally for the number of cities and villages registered by the World Crafts Council. Here's more.
The 15th Tehran International Tourism and Handicrafts Exhibition has wrapped up its work. The four-day event brought together representatives of different sectors active in tourism and handicrafts fields, including airlines, cruise lines, hotels, museums, travel agencies, insurance services, travel and tourism facilities, and masters of handicrafts. The exhibition is considered as the most appropriate platform to optimize face-to-face communication among the involved industries. From a tourism point of view, Iran enjoys two important and unique features. The first one is Iran's exceptional geographical location among countries in the world, and the second feature is its tourism attractions of historical, cultural, natural pilgrimage, adventurous, and other sorts.
Qalamzani, or metal engraving, is an Iranian ancient metalwork art. It is engraved by chisels and hammers on different metals such as gold, silver, copper, brass, and some alloys. Its origin dates back to almost 7,000 years ago. It is the art of carving superb designs on various metals. The artistic work of this course made by the artists are the glorious and undeniable indication of previous metal work of Iran, and in particular Isfahan.
I'm from Hormozgan province, south of Iran. Handicrafts have always been an integral part of Hormozgan province due to the rich culture and special customs of the region. Hormozgan province embraces scenic islands, among which Kish, Hormoz, Hengam, and Qeshm are the most beautiful ones and top tourist destinations in southern Iran.
Iran has globally registered 11 cities and 3 villages under their native handicrafts during the past 6 years, making the country a world leader in registering local productions. There are totally 602 handicrafts fields identified on a global scale. 299 fields are special to Iran, from which 199 fields are in the central Iranian province of Isfahan.
With 14 entries, Iran ranks first globally for the number of cities and villages registered by the World Crafts Council, as China, with 7 entries, Chile with 4 entries, and India with 3 ones, come next. Salman Khojouri, Tehran.
Joyous festive mood in East Asia as the region welcomes the Lunar New Year with celebrations, including light and lantern decorations of homes and public avenues. People across China are staging a variety of events to mark the New Year, also known as the Spring Festival. Several cities have held breathtaking light shows, with many landmarks and skyscrapers dazzling with colorful images. In the capital, Beijing, the light shows feature elements of the Winter Olympics as the the city is getting ready to host the International Games this week. Elsewhere, Malaysians welcome the Year of the Tiger with an underwater lion dance performance in an aquarium in the capital, Kuala Lumpur. The citizens have welcomed the return of the annual event, which had been called off the previous year due to COVID-19 restrictions.
A lot happier as compared to during the lockdown period where you're alone and you do things alone. You feel very lonely, right? Now that you get to be in touch with your family, yeah, it's a lot better.
Even though we still keep the social distance, but however, I feel the freedom to go out and visit and do the things that I like to do.
Celebrations are also underway in Hong Kong, Taiwan and Indonesia. The Lunar New Year, seen as a time of reunion and rebirth, is celebrated by more than 2 billion people worldwide, especially amongst Asian communities. The festivities last for over a fortnight.
Stunning light shows and hanging lanterns have illuminated cities across China to welcome the new Lunar Year, also called the Spring Festival. The city of Zigong has taken the spotlight with a sea of lanterns, turning it into a scene straight out of a fairy tale. The city is famous for lantern making and brings a festive mood this time around every year. The lanterns are usually made in all kinds and shapes, including legendary creatures representing each lunar year on the Chinese calendar. This year's zodiac is the tiger, which is decorated vividly on special couplets. The New Year festivities officially begin on Tuesday and will continue for 15 days. The Lunar New Year is considered the largest migration of people in the world, as millions travel back to their towns and villages to mark the event.
Sub-zero temperatures in the Midwestern U.S. haven't held anglers back from participating in the world's largest charitable ice fishing contest. Some 10,000 people from across the world gathered in the state of Minnesota to put their ice fishing skills to test. They dug thousands of holes in Gull Lake in a matter of hours. Some $200,000 in prizes were up for grabs in the contest. The volunteer-led annual event has so far raised about $4 million for 67 charities since it was first held in 1991.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
Murat Kurnaz, a Turkish citizen born and raised in Bremen, Germany, who says he had travelled to Lahore, Pakistan to study the Holy Quran at a Pakistani school, was handed over to the US even though he had no ties to Al-Qaeda, nor had he visited a terrorist camp. He spent 1,600 days enduring various forms of torture at the US military prison at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. We have prepared for you an article written by Philip Alterman. The piece is titled, Mother of Guantanamo Detainees Still Waiting for US and German Apologies. The mother of a German-born Guantanamo Bay detainee held at the camp for 6 years and tortured has said she is still waiting for an apology or compensation as a new film sheds light on a story she says remains an open wound. In Rabia Kurnaz vs. George W. Bush, which premiered at the Berlin Film Festival on Saturday, 12th of February, the director Andreas Dresen, whose socially engaging filmmaking has led him to be described as Germany's answer to Ken Loach, revisits the case of Murat Kurnaz, who was arrested without explanation in Pakistan in October of 2001, just a month after the suspicious 9/11 attacks. Murat Kurnaz, a Turkish citizen born and raised in Bremen, Germany, who says he had travelled to Lahore, Pakistan to study the Holy Quran at a school affiliated with the Tablighi Jamaat missionary movement, was handed over to the United States, even though he had no ties to Al-Qaeda, nor had he visited a terrorist camp. He spent 1,600 days enduring various forms of torture at the U.S. military prison at Guantanamo Bay in Cuba. Kurnaz plays a walk-on part in the film, but its focus is on the story of his mother, Rabia Kurnaz, played by the comedian Meltem Kaptan, and Bernhard Docker, Alexander Scheer, the lawyer she won over to fight for her son's release. Aided by the British actor and activist Vanessa Redgrave, Kurnaz became one of the prominent faces of a class action lawsuit in the United States that eventually won her son the right to legal representation from the US Supreme Court. 15 years after Kurnaz was reunited with her son, in August of 2006, her lawyer has said the blame for his client's miscarriage still lies above all with the United States. Bernhard Docker told The Guardian in an interview, President George W. Bush set up an offshore legal vacuum in the Caribbean and destroyed all the procedural safeguards the Western world has known since the Age of Enlightenment. Prisoners at Guantanamo Bay were held as enemy combatants. Bernhard Docker said, they were treated like outlaws in the Middle Ages, adding, because they rejected our laws, the argument went, they did not deserve the protection of our legal system either. 39 prisoners remain in the camp, more than 20 years after it first opened. Rabia Kurnaz, however, also places blame for her son's ordeal with a country she has lived in since she was 14 years old. She told The Guardian, I hold the German government responsible for what happened to my son, adding, they should have acted more quickly. After all, Murat was born here. Three German intelligence agents interrogated Kurnaz at Guantanamo Bay a year into his detention and came to the conclusion he was innocent and did not pose a threat to national security. According to cables cited by the news magazine Der Spiegel, neither the Pentagon nor the CIA objected to the idea of releasing Murat Kurnaz to Germany. But the social